Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far, as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So this has been the first week of school for, you know, in a sense, for us. It's Bella's first week of high school, which we previewed last week.
Yes.
So how'd it go?
It went really well. I was very impressed. So we started off with this kind of a slow rollout. She's basically was doing four classes this week: history, English, geography, and religion.
Obviously.
And I'm really, really pleased. I'm using for those four subjects, I'm using the Mater Amabilis curriculum, which is a Catholic Charlotte Mason homeschool curriculum. It's free and really good. It's literature based. So they're primarily reading reading books, not textbooks. And so religion, she's reading letters from the church fathers. She's reading the Bible, and she's reading a book called The Creed in Slow Motion by Ronald Knox and Deus Caritas Est by Pope Benedict the 16th. So it's substantial. Like this week she read the first letter of St. Clement of Rome and a bunch of the Bible and the Creed in Slow Motion. In English, she is reading the Iliad. She's reading some early English literature, and she's reading Twelfth Night.
Okay.
In history, we're doing two strands of history, a world history and a national history strand. So she's doing like world history, starting with ancient world. And then she's also doing British history. She's reading Winston Churchill's History of the English Speaking Peoples.
Cool.
The British parts, not the American parts. Although she says she really wants to read the American parts, so she's making me get the unabridged Winston Churchill from the library so she can see what it's skipping.
Funny.
And then what to see? Oh, geography. She opted to focus for this term on Asia and the Middle East. And so she's reading a textbook about Asia. She's reading the book Seashell on the Mountaintops about Blessed Nicholas Steno, who was a geologist, scientist, anatomist, and who became a Catholic priest. And she's also reading Two Under the Indian Sun by Rumer Godden, who was a British novelist who became Catholic. She spent much of her childhood in India. She was born there. She was sent off to school in England, but then she returned to India when World War II started. And so Two Under the Indian Sun is a memoir that Rumer Godden co-wrote with her sister, John. That's J-O-N. And it's sort of about their childhood in India. So that kind of fits in with the Indian geography, or the Asian geography.
Right.
So she's got a book list, a list of readings that I put together on Google Docs. And she checks things off as she's done with them. And then she has a document where she writes a brief paragraph reflection about each reading.
And she's continuing to do Khan Academy math.
Right.
Next to me on the iPad every day. And she's doing algebra, right?
Yes, algebra.
Yeah, algebra.
And then this week she'll be starting a biology class through Homeschool Connections. And we're adding a civics class to her roster, reading some government and economics,
which is going to coincide with her merit badges.
Yes,
she's for scouts, so she's going to American Heritage merit badge and Which is good. So, and I'm a merit badge counselor, so that works.
And of course, in her spare time, she's continuing to read novels, historical novels about the Civil War, and a book about ravens. And
oh, she was all this week going on about how much she loves ravens, how wonderful they are.
Yes.
Crows and ravens.
It's called The Mind of the Raven by Bernd Heinrich, I think.
So how is she done? So that's the work you've assigned. So how has she done this week?
Really well. So she just has her checklists to work at her own pace. And she decided that she wanted to split it up into two blocks. And so she'd do half of the reading in the morning after she finished her math. And then she'd do the other half of the reading in the afternoon. And she said she found some of the readings kind of boring. Some of the texts, she's been reading the introductions this week, so that's kind of waiting to get to the meat of the book. And she's found some of them very interesting. She found some of the days a little bit more challenging, and some of the days she said she finished early and then she got bored because everybody else was still working, and she kind of wished she had more schoolwork to do.
At which point you said?
I said, actually, if you want to work ahead, that's free. That's fine. And I also drew some suggestions from an alternate reading list of like optional texts that she can add to her roster. So hopefully that will keep her from being bored this week.
And the others?
We're still kind of tootling along with the others. I am working on making some checklists for Sophia, but I haven't actually got my act together yet because I've been focusing on getting high school up and running. So Sophie will be in seventh grade this year, and so we're trying to transition her to a more challenging middle school reading list and curriculum. But it's, you know, we're taking it slow.
And she's still doing her math and copywork every morning when she gets up. I mean, yes. Like clockwork.
Yeah. And she's reading American history book, and we're trying to add some science and geography and other things.
Right. Bella's more in the, like, just she wants to read. She'll read everything and anything. But Sophie is much more systematic in her reading.
Right.
She forms a habit in a book. She's every night she took it on herself to start reading the Bible a few years ago.
She read her way through the entire New Testament,
yeah,
from Matthew through Revelation. And then as soon as she finished that, she flipped back to the beginning of the Bible and she started on Genesis, and she reads religiously a chapter a night usually. And so right now she's worked her way up to Isaiah, I think.
Like, that's pretty far. I mean, she made her way through Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy.
Yes, she agreed that some of those were kind of boring.
Pretty dry.
She felt like the wisdom literature was a little bit repetitive. But it's been very interesting to see a 12-year-old's take. I mean, honestly, I have never read my way through the entire Bible. So she's doing something that I haven't done. I do not have the self-discipline to do this. So I am in awe.
I mean, I have a theology degree. I've never read my way through the Bible. I mean, I know every book and I've been in every book, but I've never sat down and read from one end to the other.
Right.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
I used to look at those Bible a day, but Bibles, and I'm like, that's some commitment. That's a type of approach that isn't me.
Right.
It's definitely Sophie.
Yeah. So Isabella's program is actually going to have her read the Bible twice through the high school years. So
interesting.
Right now she's basically, it's got her reading Matthew, Genesis, and Psalms. So she started at the beginning of each of those books, and mm-hmm. she's doing a chapter of Matthew a day, a chapter of Genesis a day, and one Psalm a day.
I wonder if the Jeff Cavins approach might be good for some of them, like for who the just reading it through won't work, but who want a more narrative structure to it. Cause his approach is much more, this is the story, and it jumps and tells the story.
I think that would benefit me. Maybe I should check that out.
Yeah. I remember when he was creating that 30, almost 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting old. When we were at Steubenville, and I remember him talking about that, and just the, like, kind of blows your mind. Like it skips the boring bits. I mean, it's the Bible, it's the scripture. So everything is important, but what it does is it pulls out the narrative bits to tells the story.
Right.
And then, cause then once you understand the story, the other stuff makes sense in it, in that context.
Right.
We just have to, the, the Adventure Bible. I mean, the Adventure Bible timeline. It's timeline based.
Right.
And I think that helps give it a context. Anyway, that's a little off the
maybe when Sophie finishes her read through just cover to cover, then we could do something like that with her. She might enjoy that.
It's a
different approach.
That might be good.
I like the idea of reading the Bible over and over again and developing it as a daily habit. And that's one of the things I'm really liking about the Mater Amabilis curriculum for Isabella, is she is not going to develop this habit on her own. But it's really good. So it's got Bible reading scheduled for 3 days a week. And then the other stuff is on the other 2 days.
Okay.
It's a pretty good hefty.
Good. So
yeah,
first week of school. I mean, it's kind of funny because we do school all year round, but sometimes it's more intensity than others.
Right.
Yeah.
As Melissa Wiley calls it, tidal schooling. So we're going to high tide, where I'm in charge, I'm directing, and I'm sort of plotting a course, as opposed to the low tide when they're just kind of wandering about the beach and exploring, which is, of course, a great way to learn. You wander about the beach at low tide, lifting up rocks and looking at crabs and flotsam and jetsam, and you find all sorts of amazing things, and you don't need a guide necessarily.
That's true.
So they're both ways of learning, and they're both good.
Yep. So in addition to school this week, this Saturday, we had my mom visiting.
It's the first time she's been over since
COVID.
Yeah, I guess January or February.
I guess. I mean, yeah. I mean, my dad hasn't. Has my dad been over?
Yeah, he came over.
He did.
Not too long ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, my mom hasn't been here in ages. So my mom was...
We've, of course, visited her.
Yes, we've seen her. We sort of break the rule a little bit on the seeing, you know, the elderly parents. But, you know, it's... That's a whole nother discussion. But she lives with my brother John and his family. And she's 81. And she's going through changes, and, you know, she's elderly now. And I was just saying to Melanie, like, how weird it is to be at that stage in life where your parents are elderly. They're not the strong person they were before. My mom's always had health issues, but like mentally and emotionally, you know, I mean, as you get older, you start losing a step, as they say, and dealing with your parents no longer being that's been hard. It's kind of strange and amplified by the world we're living in 2020, of course.
Right.
So it's been I don't want to get into the exact problems that she's been having, but, you know, mentally and emotionally, you get to a point where you start not being. I got to this point with my dad a few years ago where I suddenly realized my dad is elderly. You know what I mean? Like, he was, there's this change. The conversations don't flow as easily. There's not as powerful in his speech. The conversations become much more circular because they don't remember saying this thing 3 times already in the conversation. I mean, I know I repeat myself sometimes, but.
No, you never.
I know. Well, yes, I know.
I know what you're talking about.
Thank you for that. But you know, the like three, you know, I can't count how many times yesterday she asked, like, whose birthday is coming up next? Which of the kids' birthdays is coming up next? Like, at least a half a dozen times, you know. So, yeah, it's very strange to watch your parents go through this time where they're kind of declining. I mean, your parents are still pretty vigorous.
My parents are also...
They're younger than my parents.
At least 10 years younger. My dad just turned 76, so he's...
He's 10 years younger than my dad. 10
years younger than your dad.
Yeah.
Although, my dad had a stroke 5 years ago now.
Yep.
And since then, he recovered, and fortunately, they got him to the hospital quickly enough. But he had to learn how to read again, and
physically he recovered pretty completely, right?
Well, He seemed to be recovered pretty quickly. Unfortunately, he didn't get the physical therapy he needed. And so then his muscles actually on that side started to atrophy because they right. weren't getting the exercises they needed.
So he actually declined afterward.
He actually declined after the stroke. And so he's been actually undergoing physical therapy now, like the stuff that he should have had immediately yeah. after the stroke.
Right. But his speech patterns have really suffered.
Right.
And his hearing.
His hearing was already going, but
right.
And actually, in one of the sort of benefits, not benefits, but the things that happened after the stroke was that he was forced to acknowledge that his hearing was going and get a hearing aid,
right.
Which he had needed. We all acknowledged for a long time. He was playing the television really loudly and that yep. sort of thing. So he has hearing aids now and he has aphasia. He occasionally just forgets words and he, uses like the wrong pronouns. So following his conversation can sometimes be difficult because he'll say she instead of he, or
that could get you into big trouble these days.
Yeah. I kind of worry about that, like dad mispronouncing somebody because he does it to everybody.
Right.
And then, yeah, I mean, he can have conversations, but like on the phone is really difficult. And if there's more than one person, people talking in the room, he really can't follow it.
Right.
And he's, you know, he's definitely getting older and frail, but he doesn't really let it slow him down that much. He's still working right. in the garden and cooking dinners and all that stuff.
But he gets tired easier, like especially when he's here with all the kids, yeah. which we haven't seen him in a year. But
yeah, I think they've actually said he has a sleep disorder of some kind that the stroke triggered.
Yeah. So it's hard to watch yeah. your parents go through that to, you know, as the child to see them. You know, these people that were your rock, that you were the center of your world, that you relied on, you leaned on, that they were always there, you know, that and now, you know, they're not in that way. And like, especially when you're an adult child, you hopefully get to a point with your parents where you have an adult relationship. You can relate to them in an adult way and you have interesting conversations and fun times and joy and all those things that you can relate to another adult with, you know, like they're still your parent, but there's still that way of relating. But then there comes that time where they can't. I mean, thank God they're still around. I mean, that's a blessing yes. in and of itself. My mom lost her dad when my mom was 7, he was 45, I think it was. I never knew him. So it's nice for them to be around still, but it's hard to see them in their decline. Pope John Paul talked about that, I think. Pope Francis might have too, about the importance of elderly family members to teach us something about life at the end of life. So
right,
it's interesting. Anyway, so it was nice to see my mom and for her to be around the kids and have dinner with her. That was nice.
Yeah, it was very nice. Nice visit.
So we usually talk about what we're cooking and eating, and hopefully we talk about something that new that we've cooked or made, but we really haven't made anything new lately this week.
No, not really.
We're kind of in that transition period between summer and fall. And so
focusing on school and stuff yeah. that tends to take my attention away from cooking. And I fall yeah. back on the easy stuff.
Right. Burgers and sausages on the grill, the chicken thighs, pasta and sauce. We actually had mussels in sauce, you know, in the red sauce, the tomato sauce last night. But we've talked about that before. But we're making a lot of our favorites. But yeah, I've got some plans. I've got some dishes I'm thinking about. But I figured today we could talk about something, some of our hard-won thoughts.
This basically our thoughts while cooking tonight, as yeah. we're like cooking and making dinner together. We sort of talked about, you know,
things we've learned
and the challenges of feeding yep. a family of 7.
Yes. And lessons we've learned about feeding our kids. And this is important because there are a lot of people out there who want to give you, anyone who's a parent already knows this, there are a lot of people out there who want to give you advice on how to raise your kids. This is the secret you need to know. This is going to fix things. No, because every family is different, obviously.
Every child is different.
Every situation is different. All we're going to do is talk about what we've done that has worked for us. And if you find something in it that you want to try that might help you, God bless you. Take it and run with it. But don't look at any of this as this is what you should do because this is what works, because it probably won't unless you have our kids as your kids. So the first thing we would talk about was there are three big errors we've tried to avoid when feeding kids. The first one is only cooking meals of things that the kids are willing to eat. So only making pasta all the time, or basically denying our ability to eat adventurous food.
We've always both been adventuresome eaters.
Yes.
And we didn't want to lose that when we had kids. In fact, we would like to raise adventuresome eaters so that they can enjoy food with us.
Right.
However, we've discovered that children are not always so adventuresome. And so we've struggled as parents feeding children to balance our adventuresome eating, our desire for our children to become adventuresome eaters, and the fact that we've got some picky kids and some other challenges like food allergies on our plates.
Right. Everybody's gone through those seasons. You know, the age and the time where the kid will only eat white foods, rice, pasta, bread, potatoes.
Although evidently some people have magical kids who do not go through this stage.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. One thing we've avoided are the kids who won't eat meat. I know plenty of people who've had kids who I'm a vegetarian. I refuse to eat meat.
Yeah. Watch out, because who knows who will come into that stage at some point.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine. Well, Bella is old enough now, and Sophie is old enough that they're pretty set in there. Like, I cannot imagine Sophie ever giving up meat. That girl loves meat.
It's true.
So I don't.
But you never say never. I mean,
well, but that's the thing is one of the things I've always tried to do is to make it clear to them what you're eating is, like, where it comes from, how it gets to your plate. I mean, though, we've, like, with the lobsters, we always joke about, like, the kids playing with the lobsters before we put them in the pot and that sort of thing. But the fact is they see the lobster, they like the lobster, they play with the lobster. Bye-bye, lobster, you're about to be my yummy dinner. Like, there's no sentimentality in it. There's no...
Right. I mean, yeah, I don't have a lot of patience, and I'm sorry if people in our audience feel this way, but I don't have a lot of patience for the... I refuse to eat meat because, like, it was a cute animal at one point. And, like, that moment of a child suddenly realizing that their food was a living animal at some point. So we've tried to take them to farms so they understand, like,
right,
these are the chickens, and they are going to taste very yummy on our,
yes,
on our table.
See those pigs? Those are walking bacon. And they get it. You know, they see cows. We talk about where beef comes from. They've watched Good Eats. They've seen, you know, these shows where it talks about where animals come from, you know, where food comes from. So we've avoided that. And hopefully we will continue to avoid that. But we have the things like we talked about. So we kind of got off track there. So the first thing was the first mistake that we avoided was only cooking meals featuring foods that the kids are willing to eat, and thus denying our and their ability to eat adventurously. Thank you. Sorry. The second error that we tried to avoid is forcing them to eat whatever we cook that, you know, that's according to our taste. You know, make a Vietnamese dish with, you know, fish sauce and things in it and say, this is dinner. Eat it or go hungry.
I know that that's some people's philosophy of cooking. You eat what's on the table,
we don't have a menu,
or you go to bed hungry. And I just, as a child, I would not have liked being treated that way. And I don't really want.
I was treated that way at times.
I don't want to treat my children that way. Under the sort of don't do to other people what you don't want to have done to you.
Well, when you get into the battle of the wills, I mean, you're just that.
I don't see how you're going to raise people who enjoy eating if eating becomes a fight, a food fight, you know,
right.
A battle.
Gosh, I remember the it was either the battle over the okra or the battle over the shrimp. Now, mind you, when my mom would make like shrimp, like bouillabaisse, it was the tiny Maine Gulf shrimp. And they were always way overcooked and they just didn't taste good. And I refused to eat them.
I remember those from childhood. They tended to be really rubbery. And
yes, they were always overcooked because they're so tiny. They needed like 10 seconds in the hot water and everything was just nobody knew how to cook them back then. So I think it was the okra, though. The battle of over the okra, which I hated. My mom was not from the South, so she didn't know how to cook it. So it was slimy and gross. And I remember she said, "You are not leaving this table until you eat that okra." And I sat there till like 10 o'clock at night. And she finally said, "Fine, go to bed."
My parents never did the "you're not leaving this table."
Yeah. Well, it's a losing proposition because you've set up a battle of the wills and then it becomes somebody's going to have to blink. And right. Probably the parent who's got other things to do.
I never really wanted to be engaged in that.
Yeah.
Struggle.
I know I do that in other ways, and I did it today again with something else, the ultimatum and the battle of the will, because that's the way I was raised, and I forget sometimes to not do it. But we don't usually do that over the food, so we don't force them that, you know, this is not a diner and you have to eat what's here. If it's something that they're not likely to like, we'll sometimes either make a box of mac and cheese or, you know, plain pasta to go along with the sauced pasta dish like we had tonight or
right.
something like
that. Right. Tonight we had like a lemon pasta with a cream sauce and broccoli and mushrooms and artichoke hearts in it. And some of the kids kind of looked at that and said, "No, thank you.
Yeah,
I'll take some plain pasta with no sauce on it."
Right.
And we've always made that into an option that the kids can do. I try to make like some unsauced right. pasta and some sauced. Yeah.
And if they don't want to eat what's for dinner and they're going to eat mac and cheese, they can make the mac and cheese. Like they know how they're old enough now. They can make it.
Right.
Or they go make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich right. or something else.
Right. But I mean, we discovered when they're toddlers, are you really going to make a toddler eat hot curry? Of course not. That would be...
Right.
No.
Cruel.
It would be cruel. And so, you know, we sort of, because we wanted to continue to eat things like curry, we compromised on the, like, children eating everything that we eat.
Right.
Now, we certainly encouraged them to try the curry, and some of our children liked curry, even as toddlers. But we never made it into a battle of the wills. We let them eat some rice, or I would cook some chicken without the curry sauce and let them eat that. Or
But we usually say, just take a bite. Just take a no thank you bite. Just try it. Just taste it. Right. And you don't have to eat anymore if you don't like it. And that usually works. I mean, sometimes it takes right. a little cajoling. Right.
And I sort of play it by ear. A child who is clearly tired or stressed is not going to be cajoled to take right. a new thank you bite. I try to, you know, pick my timing, pick my battles. We only really do the no thank you bites when they're kind of upbeat and engaged.
Right. Now, there's another error that we try to avoid that's sort of the opposite of that, which is assuming they won't try anything and making separate meals for everybody. Like I've heard from friends that was their solution was everybody just gets whatever they want for dinner. And I mean, if there's three of you, maybe that works, but I can't imagine trying to juggle that. That's like running a restaurant. You know, you got a menu and you can have steak, you can have pasta and sauce, you could have, and trying to make three different or four different or five different meals. That's a recipe for disaster. That'll drive you nuts. I think it teaches the wrong lesson. I think I like the idea that, especially as they get older, if you want something different, you make it. And we're going to start teaching you how to cook. And then maybe soon you'll be making dinner for everyone. Oh boy. When we get to that point, I'm really excited. When they start cooking for us, that's going to be nice. My brother's kids do that for them now. John.
Yeah. We're getting there slowly.
Yes,
but
we're getting
there. It's a process.
I was talking to Anthony tonight about what he would like to try to make, like if he wants to start cooking. He wants to start making my pancakes,
Fun.
Yeah. I said, yeah, and he's already got some of the techniques down, so he knows what some things he has to do. So other things that are sort of related to this, that we've hard-won lessons, children need a balanced diet, but not at every meal. Like, they... doctors, you know, pediatricians, nutritionists, all, you know, make sure that you have the plate with, you know, this, you know, a fistful of protein and a fistful of...
Well, I found that while the books suggest that sort of thing, the actual doctors, like the actual pediatricians...
Well, we've had good pediatricians.
Right. Have always sort of said, you know, healthy, balanced diet is sort of... over days or like a week, not at every meal. Right. So you might have a day when the child eats nothing but carbs, and a day when a child eats nothing but fruit, and a day when the child eats nothing but
protein.
Yeah. Especially when they're like two or three and their stomach is the size of a walnut and they're not going through a growth spurt. They just seem to eat air.
Right.
And that's okay. Try to give them a variety of options at every meal and try to... But don't make it a battle if they don't want all the options at every meal.
Yeah, like one, like with Anthony, like usually we have to encourage him. All right, you can have more of the chicken or whatever dish, but you have to eat two broccoli stems, or two heads of florets, sorry, of broccoli, or four pieces of green bean, or whatever it is, and he'll do it. And then he'll have a piece of fruit.
Right. He is especially resistant to fruits and vegetables and would tend to never eat fruits and vegetables if he wasn't made to.
Right. So we really do want to encourage him at the meals to eat these even a little bit.
But on the other hand, Bella early on absorbed the idea of a balanced meal and started making herself plates that would have a neat serving of fruit and vegetables yes. And a protein and a starch at every meal,
right. You know,
with a glass of milk. Like when she was like seven, I think she started doing that, like for lunches and breakfasts and things. It was very cute.
Right.
She isn't quite that on target now, but at least she has sort of a habit of generally balancing her own diet, which is nice to see.
But the key is like over time, just not like, don't worry that they're only eating a slice of bread and a bowl of pasta for dinner and it's going to be terrible. I mean, it would be better if they had something else, but and that kind of feeds into the other thing, which is, you make a fruit plate at every dinner, like our aim is at every dinner, nearly every dinner, we have a plate where you've cut up some fruit.
Yeah. Just whatever is seasonal, apples, oranges,
grapes,
strawberries,
peaches tonight. And it was a really good peach. Sweet. Just something there on the table. And sometimes they'll just eat it. Sometimes it's have some fruit before you have some more.
Can I have a third helping of meat? Yeah. Have a piece of fruit, please.
Right.
You know.
And then when they start and it tastes really sweet and good and yummy because it's in season.
Most of the time, they'll have a little bit more. Sometimes they're just done.
Depends on the child.
Yeah.
One thing we do that, I think this is the one thing we've been best at, which is sitting down to dinner every night, to all of us.
My mom always made it a point of sitting down to dinner. Even if she, you know, had a choir rehearsal and the dinner was, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken or a pizza, we sat down to dinner as a family.
Yeah. But when I was fourth of five and my parents were split at the time, you know, when I was preteen and teen. So my older siblings were out and about and going here, there, working jobs or going out with their friends. My mom was tired, barely had the energy to get food on the table. Sometimes we ate in front of the TV. Sometimes we just, you know, grab food and eat. And I've heard from people where they the family doesn't eat together. They just eat on the go. And I mean, again, you do what works for you. If that works for you, that's fine. But if you're looking for some, you know, to change something, maybe trying that, you know, sitting down because sitting down to dinner, I mean, we're not perfect about it, because the one thing that we do that we probably shouldn't do is you and I at some point in the dinner, usually pull out our phones and we're,
yeah,
we're looking at email or checking messages or, you know, what's in the news or whatnot.
Yeah. And as the kids get older, that will probably have set a terrible precedent.
Well, it has, because as Bella has said to me, oh, it's that point in the meal where you take out your phone. So I know the conversation is done. that one's done. So, yeah, it's. You know, this is one of our struggles. So learn a lesson from a thing that we shouldn't be doing. Maybe we shouldn't even bring our phones to the table.
Right. It's hard. I'm tired. Sometimes my ability to converse lags.
Right. And sometimes you just need a fidget.
Right.
And like just you playing the mindless game is a fidget.
Right. It is. And sometimes the phone is actually a tool because like the family is having a conversation and we want to look something up.
Like, right.
I'm going to look up that word. I'm going to look up, oh, what does that mean? Or
who was this person? What was this moment in history?
And sometimes, I mean, it turns out into like these great homeschooling sort of conversations where we're like talking about history or talking about poetry or talking about art
or current music. Events or right. Well, in fact, that's one of the reasons why sitting down to dinner is such a great thing, because these conversations just start. They develop. And we don't like I don't like the whole like, what was one thing you learned today, and have these formalized, you know, inquiries. It's not really at me. And
I can see there being a utility to that. Just sort of learning how to
converse. Right, right. I'm not saying no, people shouldn't do it. I'm just saying it's not me.
Right.
I've never been the icebreaker sort of person. so that's something to think about.
Although the kids seem to really like that. They have an icebreaker game that they play on their own spontaneously called Have You Ever Had a Dream About? And somebody will announce like a topic and then they'll go around the table and everybody will say whether or not they've had a dream about that
thing. Well, there are some of those sorts of games that I actually do enjoy playing with them where, yeah. And some of those times are moments where I can, you know, reveal a little bit about me and my past and who I am to them, which is kind of fun because I think, especially as they get older, they enjoy learning about us.
They do.
I remember enjoying learning about my parents as I got older.
Yeah, sometimes they'll say, wow, I've never heard this story, Mom. I can't believe this about you.
You did what?
I can't
what?
Believe I didn't know this about you.
Did Grandma ground you? So another thing that I want to know if this was a conscious decision on your part or not, but we've never really given them juice or soda. They drink very, milk and water.
Very conscious. I mean, I think I read an article early on that was talking about how juice is basically no better than soda. Like it's just
sugar water. Right.
And
we were fed this idea when we were kids that juice was healthy.
Right. So I was very conscious from that. Like I went through almost a kind of a crunchy, like trying to keep no sugar or very low sugar foods.
That was fun.
Yeah. I've rolled some of that back, but I still, we have juice at special occasions. They get juice sometimes if we go out to dinner. But as a rule, we don't have juice at home. And milk, I was always very paranoid about, you know, people sharing stories about like milk cups ending up in the car and stinking, or milk cups finding them behind the couch and smelling. So I had a very firm rule when they were smaller that milk was only in cups with lids and it was only consumed in the kitchen or the dining room. And it did not leave those rooms.
Right.
Ever. They could take cups of water into the car or tootle around the house with them. And I was fine with that. If they had lids and straws.
Yes.
But milk never left. So milk was basically a mealtime drink. It was not a right. snack drink, and no juice. So our kids do drink a lot of water.
Yes.
And they drink milk. Some of them drink milk at every meal.
We go through a lot of milk. I mean, we buy a gallon of milk about every day and a half, which I know for some families is not that much. But for I think that's substantial. So
that was definitely conscious on my part.
Yeah.
I know some people,
they give juice like to their kids like crazy.
And they do not drink sodas ever.
Yeah.
I don't think any of them, they've made of like tried a sip of soda. They've never been served soda.
They probably drank more beer and wine than they have soda.
Absolutely. They have drunk more beer and wine than soda.
Whenever I have a beer or we ever have wine, they want to taste it, which is, we're fine with that.
My parents raised us having sips of the beer and wine at dinner. I mean, we're Catholic, so we get, they wanted us to, for first of all, to get used to the taste of wine before we like first received communion.
Yeah.
So wine as like a sip of mom or dad's wine at dinner was sort of, at least from first communion age, it was one of those things that my parents
and I'm Italian.
Did.
Like they like by the time they're 14, 15, like at Thanksgiving or Christmas this year, I'd be fine with Bella having a glass of wine with dinner or even Sophie.
And, you know, that really stood my parents' position on drinking small glasses of wine with dinner. But by the time I was in high school, I was served a glass of wine at dinner at like Thanksgiving and Christmas. And even sometimes Sunday dinner, if they opened a bottle of wine, they'd give me a little bit.
Yeah.
When I went away to college my freshman year, I did not drink.
Right.
Now, my sophomore year in the spring, I did a semester abroad in Italy. And the school's policy at that time, they've actually changed it since then, was that since you are legal to drink in this country, you are allowed to do so. And you are allowed to have beer and wine in your dorm rooms on campus, but no hard alcohol.
Wow. That was so, that seems to be a recipe for disaster.
Well, unfortunately, it was a recipe for disaster and a student died.
Oh, no.
Some year, not my year, but some years after I'd graduated.
Alcohol poisoning or accident while drunk?
Accident while drunk. I think he fell off a balcony.
Ooh.
So after that, I think they changed some of the policies. But the current campus that they have actually has its own vineyard and bottles its own wine.
Right.
So anyway, after I came back from a semester abroad where I was legal to drink, I confess that I felt less compunction about the drinking.
You felt entitled about drinking.
I felt kind of entitled. And so I did drink.
I can picture
more.
You as a 20-year-old college student with so entitled and oh my gosh, that'd be funny. I wish I knew you then.
But the practice of like saving alcohol for meals did, I think, inoculate me to some of the excesses that a lot of kids hit when they're in college. They're not under mom and dad's rules.
Take the mystery out of it. That's the big thing. Take the mystery out of it and take the, like, if you drink, you get drunk out of it.
Right. My parents never drank to the point of drunkenness. They did not like the idea of intoxication, but they did enjoy some wine at dinner.
By the time our kids are going off to college, I want to be able to, like, where we could sit down and have a beer, you know, that sort of thing. And yet the law is the law. And when you're not in our home, you obey the law wherever you are. I mean, that's clear. And you never drink and drive. I mean, those are the obvious things. But
right.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, one thing we didn't mention with the milk is what kind of milk we've always decided on.
Whole milk.
My mom was always skim milk because skim milk is healthier. In fact, that's what doctors will tell you. That's what restaurants will serve you.
My mom was 2%.
Yes.
Not skim.
My mom tried skim. We revolted. And so she went to like 2%. Whole milk, what people don't get is like 2%. It's only 2% of the milk of whole milk. No. Whole milk is 3%. You're like, it's instead of taking like 98% of the milk out, like most people, fat out, like most people think, it's just taking a third of the fat out.
I still can tell the difference,
though. No, but to put it another way, it's only a third more of the fat. Like, it's only 1% more is fat. But yet it tastes so much better. And our kids are not obese. They're not overweight. They are just fine with whole milk. Whole milk has all of the things in it that growing kids need.
Well, I've read some studies early on too that suggested that in fact your body metabolizes the vitamins better with fat than
they're
fat
soluble vitamins in milk, which kind of makes sense.
same
probably
thing
why it's there.
Right. Same thing actually with like a lot of the vitamins in like greens, like salad greens, they're fat soluble. So that's why salad dressing or butter or oil on cooked green vegetables is actually the best way to eat them.
It's healthier.
I was so happy when I read that study because it took all the guilt. Like, I had the roommate in college who would never eat salad dressing because it was too fattening. And I was just like, I felt so vindicated because no, you're getting less nutrients out of your salad if you get rid of all the fat. Now, your fat could be in the form of cheese or avocados or other things. It doesn't have to be salad dressing.
Healthy fats, certainly.
There are certainly better fats than others, but I really felt so vindicated.
On the milk thing, I recommend a book, Mark Kurlansky's book, Milk. If you want to find out about everything you ever wanted to know about milk and more.
I still have to finish that.
Oh, my gosh.
I have it on Kindle, and I've started it, and I got
sidetracked. Mind-blowing. In fact, I'm going to make a note to put that in the show notes, the link to it, because, I mean, the number of children who died from tainted milk at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, which led to laws about the quality of milk, but, like, horrific numbers of children who died from tainted
milk. I remember reading about some of the things they would do to
extend it.
Extend milk, like adding chalk powder to it.
Oh, yes.
All sorts of
hundreds of children in a neighborhood dying. Like crazy, like wild. But he also gets a lot into the benefits of milk. Why milk? Why we drink animal milk? Like when you think about it, it's kind of weird. But you know, that sort of thing. So moving on from the beverages. one of the things we talked about was how we sort of served appetizers for the kids.
Right. In keeping with the idea that nutrition is about the whole day or the whole week.
Yes.
Because some of the kids are sort of more vegetable and fruit resistant, I've discovered, though, that there are some things that they like. Like some of my kids will eat raw green beans or raw mushrooms, but they won't eat them cooked. And so when I'm cutting up mushrooms for a dish, I'll save some of them out raw and hand them to the kids and they will gobble them up.
Right. In fact, they would sometimes gobble more of them than there would be no dish left for to cook.
Right. I would have to kind of slap their hands away after a while. I also discovered that appetizers in the form of olives are really great for getting some extra
put a bowl of olives on the table or pickles or. Cucumbers, Lucy loves, when I'm making salad, I'll cut some extra cucumber.
I have to say, one of the mistakes I made when the kids were toddlers is I was so afraid of them choking and dealing with really hard, crunchy foods that I kind of avoided carrot sticks and celery and things for them to munch on. And so a lot of our kids kind of have aversion to raw carrots, raw celery, those very crunchy vegetables.
Yeah.
If I could go back, one of the things I would do was introduce them much earlier.
But even things like cheese and crackers and other stuff, I know some parents and some advice is, they'll ruin their dinner. I was told, don't eat before we're going to be eating in a half hour. Don't eat anything. You'll ruin your dinner.
Well, I try to avoid cookies and chips and junk food before dinner because I certainly would rather them be hungry enough to eat a more.
Well, you eat the thing you've made. And that's what I was going to say is I know that a large portion of that is I don't want to go through all the effort and expense of making this dinner and then have you show up at the table and go, I'm not hungry. I'm full. And it'd be a waste of my time and effort. So there's that. But they don't need to be starving at dinner. In fact, your life will be better. Our lives are better if they're not starving out of their mind.
Right. I found that
in the
they
half
actually
hour leading
still,
up to sitting down to eat.
They'll actually still eat a fairly good dinner if they have a little bit of something like the appetizer idea.
Well, I mean, think about it. Restaurants have learned are onto something. If you give someone an appetizer, it primes the pump. It makes you hungrier. It gives it doesn't fill you up. Like if appetizers, those sorts of things made people less hungry, the restaurants probably wouldn't be pushing them on us, right?
Although you order the appetizer before you actually
sometimes
order
in
your
fine
meal.
Dining restaurants you don't,
right?
And especially in the ones where they just bring stuff out.
Oh gosh, I love that.
Yes,
when you're just sitting there and they're just like,
oh, I have an amuse bouche for you. You're gonna amuse my mouth. Yummy.
I remember the first time I was at a restaurant that did that and I was shocked. I'm like, but they're just bringing you food for free that you didn't order? I don't understand this.
It's like restaurants in Rome, right? You go into a restaurant and they're like, here's some food. Oh, we didn't order this. No, it's just here. Here's just food. Don't worry about it. We'll figure out what you want later. But here's some food. Okay. Oh my gosh, that was one of my favorites.
I suppose the only time I've ever really experienced that is Mexican restaurants in Austin bring you the chips and salsa as soon as you sit down. Like, they're not charging you extra for them, and they're not, you don't have to order them. Well, they just
up here they do. That's the funny thing.
Right, that's the culture shock for me. It's like, wait, you have to order chips and salsa and pay for them?
Right.
No, they're just,
that's one of the reasons I like Sombrero over here in Weymouth. Is they do it the southern way. It's like they just bring the chips and salsa. Gosh, remember we went to Arandas in Austin, and it was, I was like, just leave the pitcher of salsa.
And they will.
Like, they come by with a pitcher of salsa and just pour it into the bowl.
Right, like the plastic pitchers that they usually pour water out of.
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
Oh my gosh, I remember that. I mean, I'm going to order food because I feel guilty if I don't pay you, but I just could just sit and eat the chips and salsa because it was so good.
Totally.
Oh man. Yeah, now you got me thinking about that. Ruined my dinner. Any other things? That's all the stuff we thought about while we were cooking dinner. I'm sure there's more things we could say.
That's
probably enough. I'd love to hear other people's lessons that they've learned with their kids. Because what works for us may not work for you, and what's worked for you may not work for us, but there may be some tips and tricks.
I always love the parenting conversations, not when somebody's like telling everybody what to do, like I'm dispensing wisdom, but just like, hey, these are cool tips and tricks that I found work for me.
These are things I've done. Maybe they'll work for you. Maybe they won't.
Frequently, there's some nuggets of gold in there.
I do that. Yeah. I mean, I do that with like computer hacks all the time. Like someone's like, oh, I'm doing this thing. And I'm like, well, I don't do that at all. But that one bit of that I could repurpose.
Right.
And same thing. So let us know. Betts, BETTS at SQPN.com. We'd love to hear from you. So let's move on to what we've been reading or watching. So I'll go because
okay.
I have more to talk about, I guess.
As usual.
Yes. So I watched on Netflix, there was a new movie starring, what was his name? I keep thinking his name is Wayans, but it's not. It's called Project Power. On Netflix, and Jamie Foxx. I always mix up Jamie Foxx with the Wayan brothers because they both were on TV at the same time. Never mind. Anyway, Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Those are the two names you'd recognize the most. And they were. It takes place. It's set in New Orleans, and any movie set in New Orleans.
What's the name of the movie?
It's called Project Power.
Project Power. Yeah. Okay.
Any movie set in New Orleans is one of the characters.
Pretty much.
I mean, movies be set in Chicago, New York, you know, Boston even, blah, blah, blah. But when it's in New Orleans, New Orleans is a huge part of it. So anyway, it envisions a world in which a company has developed these pills that when you take it, it makes you express a superpower that is your superpower. But it only lasts for 5 to 10 minutes.
5 to 10 minutes?
Right. Turns out that there's a secret government, and you find out early on, very early on this. So I'm not spoiling anything, but there's a company that is trying to develop one trying to make it permanent, and they've been banned from defense contracting and doing this in public. So they're selling them on like as a street drug, and trying to perfect it by getting it out into the, you know, testing it on people in the street. Which is creating huge problems because you have these people who are expressing these superpowers, sometimes not in their control. Sometimes they go really bad, like they blow up. Sometimes they go crazy. Sometimes they're criminals.
Unregulated testing
on people.
On people via illegal drugs.
Right. And of course, as you expect, the cops can't stop these guys. And so you have this one cop who is surreptitiously taking the drug on the side to help him, you know, deal with the superpowered criminals. And then you have the Jamie Foxx's character who I won't reveal why because that comes out in the course of it, but who's trying to find the people behind it. He has a reason that he's trying to find, and he's somehow involved with with the origin of this. So there's Jamie Foxx, there's Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the cop, and then this girl called Dominique Fishback. She's a high school student, and she's involved too. She's a street dealer, but she's not taking it. But she's trying to raise money for her sick mom to get an operation. I mean, that's a huge cliche. So it's another one of these superhero movies where it's sort of sort of a cynical look. So kind of like, as I mentioned, The Boys and these other movies where the superpowers.
Is it a movie or a TV show?
Movie.
OK.
Where the superpowers are a net negative. They're not a benefit to society.
So it's a net negative to society, but OK, but positive sometimes for individuals.
I'm trying to think of any case where it was a net positive for the individual. I can't think like. I mean, the cop who was taking it on the side was surviving these encounters with superpowered villains, but it was bad for society, certainly, that you had superpowered villains out there. And there weren't any, like, there was no Superman. You know what I mean? There was no Justice League of superheroes. It was pretty much mostly villains or people just out of control with these superpowers.
Interesting.
I've seen a couple of these in this vein. These sorts of movies. There's a lot of these superhero movies, and it's interesting to see that the superhero the way the superhero genre has moved is darker, very dark.
Interesting.
And I wonder if that's because the comics have comic books in general have gotten darker. I mean, the whole Batman genre, Batman: The Dark Knight, is very dark. It's ever since Frank Miller, I think. Ages ago, decades ago, but he really kind of took Batman in that really darker direction. I may be wrong. I mean, and I'm open to being corrected on that. I'm not an aficionado of comic books, but that's just my general sense. But the movies about it lately, and to some extent, the TV shows have taken a real dark look at superpowers. I wonder what that says.
I almost wonder if there's like this sort of a natural progression, like you've exhausted all the possibilities, you've played out all the tropes,
right?
And maybe there's a sort of a tendency to,
well, I mean, that's sort of what The Boys is about, is like, what if Superman were a homicidal megalomaniac with his powers, you know? That's,
although I think some of the Marvel movies are not nearly so dark and cynical.
No, in fact, the Marvel movies are completely still the old way. That's one of the things that distinguishes the DC movies from the Marvel movies, except for Wonder Woman. That's one of the reasons why I really liked Wonder Woman over the other DC movies. Is Wonder Woman, she remains innocent, hopeful, not cynical. That's one of the things I liked about the character.
Yeah, I really liked that too.
Yeah, but the Marvel movies are definitely, especially like Captain America and Iron Man and like all those characters. Thor. You saw?
Right.
Did you see Ragnarok?
I did.
Okay, because you've seen it out of order. I was just wondering.
I've been watching them like randomly out of order. But I did see. I saw the first Thor and I saw Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've been going on for a while, so I want to move on. But Project Power, if you get Netflix, it's worth a watch. It's not the best movie, but it wasn't bad. It was pretty good. And Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt are pretty good in it.
I feel like I watched something this week and it has completely gone out of my mind. So I am going to like skip the watching thing because whatever it was, it did not make an impression. That sounds pathetic, but I'm sorry.
So the only other thing I want to mention was that I finished reading the 8th Dresden Files book. So now I'm halfway through the current list of 16 books, although number 17 apparently is coming out within weeks. And so I really am fully understanding now what you mean by how the character and the story of the Dresden Files really moves into this complex area of morality and motivations of different characters are complex. They're not cartoonish. They're not flat. Some of the bad guys are a little flatter than others, but I mean, what can you do with the, you know, the black court vampire or the red court vampire? I mean, they're pretty much what they are. Although even, you know, never mind. I'm not going to get into it. But I really like, there's some things that Harry Dresden does or says, or people that he talks to in his life. And I'm thinking, Butcher must really know Catholicism. Because it's just, there's such a clear morality in some of the things, and like old fashioned morality in some of the things he does. You know, at one point, a late teen, nearly adult woman approaches Harry, and he has the opportunity to take advantage of that situation. And a lesser writer, I think, would have said, hey, here we go. We can, you know, spice it up a bit. And Butcher goes in another direction entirely. And I'm like, wow, that is refreshing.
Right.
Although if Harry had done that, her dad would have totally taken him out. But that's a whole nother
thing.
Spoilers. No spoiler. So that's, I finished that book, and I'm reading a Star Wars book now, which I'll talk about when I finish, but I'll let you talk about a book.
Okay. Yeah. I've been doing like bopping back and forth among several different books, mostly juvenile books. A book called Elijah of Buxton about a community of, of runaway slaves in Canada. Then that disappeared for a while this week, so I didn't make much progress on that. And I picked up Betsy's Wedding, which is the final book in the juvenile series, Betsy and Tacy, which follows the girls from like the time they're six until they're adults. But the book I really wanted to talk about is a book called Infinite Hope, which was a picture book I picked up from the library. I think it was on the New Arrivals shelf. Subtitled A Black Artist's Journey from World War II to Peace. It's a memoir by Ashley Bryan, who was drafted as a young man. He was at art school, and he was drafted in World War II. And he had grown up in New York and had never really experienced segregation. He went to schools that weren't segregated. The only time he'd really experienced prejudice was when he was trying to apply to art schools, but they found his teachers and mentors found him an art school that accepted and gave scholarships on the basis of a blind, like you leave your art on the table and then the judges don't know who the art belongs to. Mm-hmm. So he had got a scholarship to art school, and that's where he was when he was drafted. And then, of course, he enters the army, and in World War II, the army was
segregated.
So he was drafted into an all-black unit. They were stevedores, which basically were
dock workers. Which is interesting. You'd think that would be the Navy.
Pretty sure he was Army. Maybe he was Navy.
Okay.
Now I'm confused.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, he did his basic training actually in Massachusetts at Camp Miles Standish.
That's actually not in Taunton. That's like in Plymouth, which is where the scout camp
actually
is.
I looked it up because I was wondering.
Oh, really?
That no, there was actually a Camp Miles Standish,
which
in
is different from
Taunton,
Miles Standish
which
State
is
Forest.
Different from Miles Standish State Forest.
Oh, okay.
But then he was his first assignment was actually in South Boston working at the docks there.
Okay.
Loading and unloading ships. There was a great story in this book. I really loved this. His unit was stationed in an old schoolhouse in South Boston, and he was assigned patrol duty in front of the schoolhouse.
Right.
And while he's, you know, patrolling back and forth, very boring, there's rules about how you are not supposed to talk to people and stuff. He got bored and he's like 18, 19 years old. There was a bunch of neighborhood kids who started coming out and, like, first of all, imitating him as he's walking back and forth, which I can just imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And he started to get, you know, he kind of eventually got bored and let down his guard and started to talk to them. And they would bring him candies and fruits. And on his days off, he'd go out to the park and the kids would come and he would teach them how to draw.
Huh.
And so he gave them drawing lessons. And eventually, like, when he was reassigned to Scotland, he actually got addresses for some of the kids and he had a correspondence going with them.
Oh, wow.
These kids from South Boston. And it was just this like really neat story. When he finally does go to he's assigned, this is amusing, as a winch operator, even though he has no idea how to operate a winch. And he seems to be fairly useless at doing all the jobs that he's assigned. He's like trying to operate the winch while reading a book of poetry and like accidentally hit some guy in the head. And they're like, oh, just I'll do it. You go help them unload the, you know, in the hold. And so he's like, even though his official duty is winch operator, they send him off to the hold. He's so bad about that that they finally just say, oh, go draw. Ashley, you're useless. Go draw. And so he, all throughout his time in the service, he filled sketchbooks with drawings, and then he would send them back home, like whenever he got a chance. He was sent to Scotland. He actually managed to finagle his way into art school while stationed in Glasgow. And then he was part of a unit that landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day and unloading the ships. And it was just a beautiful story about this one guy who spent most of the war drawing his gas mask case full of sketchbooks and pens and pencils. And when he came home, he put all of those sketches away and stopped, didn't talk about them, didn't look at them. Most of his friends didn't even know he was a veteran until 50 years later. As an established artist and illustrator of children's books, it somehow comes out that he was had served in the war. And people start to be curious. And so he submits some of his old sketches. And then 10 years after that, he gets this idea for this memoir and starts to really dig through those sketches and books and puts together the memoir. And at that time, he then starts to paint from some of his sketches paintings. And there's this sense in which he sort of starts to make peace with himself, with his post traumatic stress, everything, through the art, the paintings that he paints as an old man. It was just a really beautiful story about art, war,
segregation.
Yeah. But mostly just getting to know this really interesting guy. The book includes his sketches and paintings, as well as photographs, and then a bunch of his diary entries, but also a bunch of letters that this one friend in California, her name is Eva, that he sent a bunch of letters to, and she had collected all of his letters and saved them and then given them to, they'd set up a nonprofit organization to like promote his work. Mm. And so she donated all these letters. And so all of the letters in the book are to one person, Eva.
Interesting.
And there's a sort of conversational tone to them. There's a deep friendship that they have. Obviously, you never really find out much about her, but it's sort of this interesting window into this aspect of his life that he misses. And she's, I guess, was a friend from art school. So he talks about art with her and that sort of thing.
Cool. So it's called Infinite Hope, A Black Artist's Journey from World War II to Peace by Ashley Bryan, B-R-Y-A-N. Cool. So we've gone on and on. We're over an hour now, so we should probably round things off there. And we want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Tom E., Joseph D., Brendan C., Charles B., and Elk Antennas. It was a business account that became patron, but their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. What did you think of our discussion? If you have any advice on feeding kids, getting kids to eat, or anything else we talked about, let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And I'll put links to all of the books we talked about in the other show, the movie, in our show notes on sqpn.com. Remember to like Raising the Bets on the StarQuest Facebook page and retweet us on Twitter, where we're at SQPN, and leave comments wherever you see it. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.